From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The CIA's code of silence on the Iran-Contra affair was broken this week. Alan Fires testified that his superior in the agency told him to lie to Congress about what he knew. On today's Fresh Air, we review this new development and its implications for the Iran-Contra investigation and for the confirmation hearings of Robert Gates, the president's nominee to head the CIA. Also today, industrial designer Peter Bressler talks about the difficult business of making simple objects. Bressler was recently hired by the city of Philadelphia to find the best sidewalk trash can. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Regarding Henry, starring Harrison Ford. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council met today with the ambassador from Iraq. They reportedly demanded that Iraq turn over a complete inventory of its nuclear installations. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The diplomats officially met with Ambassador Abdul Amir Al-Ambari to ask questions about Iraq's nuclear capacity. They reportedly told him that Iraq must provide a complete list of its materials and installations or face the consequences. They did not say what they would be. Iraq was ordered in the Gulf War ceasefire resolution to provide such an inventory, but UN officials have repeatedly rejected the information given by Iraq as insufficient. After more pressure, Iraq on Sunday finally admitted that it had been operating an extensive secret program for enriching uranium. But President Bush said this week that Iraq still had not come clean. After meeting with council members today, Al-Ambari said Iraq would answer the council's questions because it didn't want to give the U.S. a pretext to bomb its nuclear facilities. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev said today that he's not planning to beg for Western aid when he meets next week with the leaders of the seven major industrial nations. Gorbachev said he doesn't expect to get Western financial aid, but he said he would try to encourage investment by foreign companies. He also said he'd attempt to get Western trade restrictions reduced. The Soviet president wasn't specific about what businesses he'd seek Western investment in, but he did say that he'd welcome cooperation in converting defense plants to civilian production. Two influential members of the Senate have charged that April Glaspie, the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, misled Congress when she described a key meeting she had with Saddam Hussein. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The meeting took place in July of 1990, just before Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. According to April Glaspie, she delivered a tough message to Hussein that the United States would not tolerate any violence in the region. But Rhode Island Senator Claiborne Pell, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and California Democrat Alan Cranston, who is a member of the panel, said they have now received classified cables Glaspie sent back to the State Department at the time. In those cables, they say, Glaspie described the meeting differently. The title of her cable was Saddam Hussein's Message of Friendship to George Bush. And according to newspaper reports, Glaspie said in that cable that Saddam Hussein was sincere in his desire for a peaceful settlement of the conflict. Critics of Glaspie's have said that had she been more confrontational with Saddam Hussein in that 1990 meeting, he might not have invaded Kuwait. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 21 points to close at 2,980.77. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1. This is NPR News. Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates said today that he may retire but will not resign. At an anti-drug conference today in North Carolina, Gates said he may resign if a measure limiting the chief's tenure to 10 years is put on the ballot. Gates' statements appeared to be at odds with those of two Los Angeles City Council members. They said they'd met with Gates and had been given the impression that the chief would retire, regardless of whether the term limit were passed. Mayor Tom Bradley also said that he believes the chief had decided to leave. The conviction of former Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry was upheld today by the U.S. Court of Appeals. Barry's 6-month prison sentence, however, was overturned. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Barry was convicted last August of one count of cocaine possession, sentenced to 6 months in jail and fined $5,000. The conviction followed a trial that lasted almost 2 months and featured an FBI videotape of the mayor smoking crack cocaine during a sting operation. In his appeal, Barry's lawyers argued his conviction violated due process because the government failed to prove that he possessed cocaine on the dates specified in the indictment. The three-judge appeals panel rejected that argument, saying there was plenty of evidence Barry possessed cocaine when the government said he did. The appeals panel did, however, order Barry to be resentenced, not because of Barry's claim the judge was prejudiced against him, but because the judge failed to follow sentencing guidelines. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The government reported a small but unexpected drop in inflation at the wholesale level last month. The 0.3% drop in the producer price index for June was the third decline in 5 months. Most economists had been expecting the rate to stay flat or to rise slightly. The June figures mean that the price of finished goods has now been moving down at an annual rate of 1.5% during the first 6 months of the year. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week has brought a breakthrough in the Iran-Contra investigation and a setback for Robert Gates, the president's nominee to direct the CIA. On Tuesday, Alan Fiers became the first former CIA official to admit criminal conduct in the Iran-Contra scandal and the first to agree to cooperate with the Iran-Contra investigation. Fiers directed the CIA's covert operations in Central America from 1984 to 86. This week in federal court, he pleaded guilty to withholding information from Congress about the Reagan administration's secret arms for hostages deal and the diversion of funds to the Contras. He confessed that he had information about the secret deal and that he told his superiors about it. Fiers said that one of those superiors, Claire George, who was the third-ranking CIA official, instructed him to lie to Congress. Fiers' testimony may lead to new information about Robert Gates, who was the deputy director of the CIA during the Iran-Contra affair. So the Senate Intelligence Committee has postponed its confirmation hearings on Gates. We've invited Tim Weiner to put these events in context. Weiner is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer based in Washington. Weiner says there is no evidence that Gates knew about the Iran-Contra affair.
There is no evidence, none, that Bob Gates, who was then the number two man at the CIA and at times acting director when the then director, William Casey, was overseas, there's no evidence on the record that Bob Gates knew about the diversion. He had had hints, and he has testified, and he testified 4 years ago when he was nominated to become director, that he had had hints. But he said they were sketchy, and although they startled him, he wasn't sure that they were true, and he'd known about this allegation for 8 weeks before the whole world knew about it, but he didn't really look into it because he didn't want to know what was going on in Central America because the CIA was barred from running guns down there, which it was helping the White House to do.
I don't understand still what would be his logic for not wanting to know.
Because it was illegal for the CIA, it was guilty knowledge, it was illegal for the CIA, Congress had banned it from providing lethal aid to the Contras. Now the White House, in the person of Ollie North and John Poindexter and National Security Council operatives and hirelings, had a pretty large-scale, multi-million dollar gun-running operation going on down there. And it has been alleged that the CIA was providing a fair amount of support to that operation. But Bob Gates has testified under oath for four and a half years now, that he didn't want to know what was going on because the CIA wasn't allowed to be involved in this.
Couldn't you say that someone already in the position that he was in has the responsibility to get to the bottom of things if they think that there's the possibility of misbehavior going on in their own operation?
Well, officials of the Central Intelligence Agency are required by an executive order of the president to report evidence of wrongdoing or of illegalities to an intelligence oversight board, and by implication, by informal arrangement, they're also supposed to tell the House and Senate Intelligence Committees about it. But Gates has said that, the evidence that he heard was really not much more than sort of corridor gossip.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tim Weiner. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's based in Washington, and he's covering the stories of Fires and Gates for the Inquirer. Now let's get back to Fires, and then we'll return to the story of Gates. How does the new information that we have now from Fires open up the Iran-Contra investigation?
Well, to put it in some perspective, this is the first time in the 44-year history of the Central Intelligence Agency that a CIA officer has walked into a courtroom, said, "I'm guilty of a crime," and has agreed to cooperate with a federal investigation of wrongdoing at the CIA. Fires has seriously implicated Claire George, who was chief of covert operations at the CIA from 84 to 88, in this cover-up. He has said that two men, both of whom held the post of chief of the Latin American division, whose names we are not allowed to utter, knew about the diversion. There is evidence on the record that other people at the CIA knew about the diversion. There is some suggestion that the National Security Agency, which conducts electronic eavesdropping overseas and is actually a much larger organization than the CIA, had picked up telephone conversations and perhaps other telecommunications concerning this diversion. What Fires has done is to establish that there was a criminal cover-up at the CIA and has, by implication, sort of darkened the atmosphere of the confirmation hearings of Bob Gates, the second round of confirmation hearings since Gates was nominated in 87, which he has caused their delay, and he has sort of exhumed the ghost of Bill Casey, the CIA director under whose aegis this all took place. Casey's ghost is now sort of floating around here in the atmosphere in Washington.
Now, the confirmation hearings for Gates have been delayed. Can you explain the reasons for the delay?
Well, the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has to pass on Bob Gates' nomination, is a body of 15 politicians, 8 Democrats and 7 Republicans. And after Fires pleaded guilty on Tuesday, they were given pause. They would like to call Alan Fires, and perhaps disastrously for independent counsel Walsh's investigation, they would also like to call Claire George, who hasn't been accused of anything but may soon be accused of something serious, to tell them, presumably what's on the public record in Fires' case, to tell them what they know about Bob Gates's knowledge of this affair. Fires stood outside the courthouse after his guilty plea and said, "I didn't tell Bob Gates. Bob Gates didn't know about this." In doing so, they have really ticked off President Bush by delaying the hearings, the Intelligence Committee has, and sort of put him into a kind of a confirmation limbo, which happens sometimes in Washington.
There's a little bit of conflict now between the Iran-Contra prosecutor Lawrence Walsh and the Senate Intelligence Committee, because the committee wants to have testimony by George, by Claire George, and also by Alan Fires. But Walsh doesn't want them to testify yet.
Because Walsh is proceeding by the rules of legal procedure, and the Senate Intelligence Committee is proceeding by the rules of a political body. And, it's sort of deja vu all over again, unfortunately, because Congress granted some immunity to Oliver North and John Poindexter to get them to testify in 1987 at the Iran-Contra hearings. And in doing so, threw a hand grenade into the legal structure of Lawrence Walsh's cases. That immunity has resulted in the, in part, has resulted in the vacating of Oliver North's convictions and may result in the vacating of John Poindexter's convictions. Walsh does not want his witnesses, or his witness, Alan Fires, up there testifying before he gets him into a courtroom.
It might hurt his case.
It would destroy his case. Or it could. So we're in a pickle here, but no one is in a worse pickle than Bob Gates is at this point. Here is a man who is a career intelligence bureaucrat who has never run a covert op in his life, who's not a spy. He's an intelligence analyst, okay? And he's also served on the National Security Council staff and now serves as President Bush's deputy national security advisor. He's a desk jockey, okay? He's an apparatchik. And he has to somehow prove this negative that he wasn't mixed up in this crazy covert operation. And unless and until he can prove that negative, he's not going to get confirmed.
President Reagan nominated Robert Gates to be head of the CIA in 87, but Gates eventually withdrew because of Iran-Contra stuff. But he first went through some of the confirmation hearings. What should we know about that he said in those confirmation hearings?
Well, I'd say that 90% of those hearings dealt with Iran-Contra and about 10% of everything else in the intelligence community, which is perhaps unfortunate for Gates. The gist of it happened in an exchange between Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, who was then on the intelligence committee, and Gates. And Specter is saying, look, are you sure you didn't know about this? Quote, it seems that among the few people in Washington who don't know what is happening are the deputy director of Central Intelligence, that's Bob Gates, and the Senate Intelligence Committee. And Gates said, well, Senator, you know, one of the aspects of our culture in the CIA is the whole world of compartmentation of operational activities in which we've grown up. If we don't have a perceived need to know about a specific operation, we try not to pursue it. I think if I'd gone in and made a big stink out of it, about it, to Director Casey, I probably could have, you know, found out what was going on. But there's the rub. He didn't know. He didn't know about the diversion, and he has to, you know, defend himself against the fact that here he is at the number two job, and he's out of the loop. There was some disbelief as to whether the number two man in the CIA could be that out of the loop. And what's poisoned the atmosphere for Gates now is that we now know that a lot more people at the CIA were in the loop than it were ever known. We know when you take the public record of Iran-Contra and you take Alan Fires' guilty plea of Tuesday, that just about everybody at the top of the chain of command knew about the diversion except Gates. And it's a very uncomfortable position for him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Weiner. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's based in Washington, and he's covering the nomination of Robert Gates to be head of the CIA, and he's also covering all the new developments in the Iran-Contra scandal. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the nomination of Robert Gates for CIA director and the latest developments in the Iran-Contra scandal with Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Tim Weiner. Now, some of the information that led to fires is from tapes of phone conversations between CIA headquarters and agents in the field. It's kind of shocking, isn't it, that after Watergate, conversations that could be incriminating were recorded and stored?
Absolutely not. In fact, the CIA is an extraordinary records-keeping outfit, as is its electronic eavesdropping counterpart, the NSA. I mean, there are miles, acres of computer tapes stored at the NSA, which has the capability of recording every telephone conversation in the world. Is it extraordinary that the CIA kept tapes of overseas conversations? Absolutely not.
What about incriminating conversations?
They're not incriminating if a prosecutor can't get his hands on them. And I think the assumption at the CIA was certainly not that these phone conversations and transcripts would be surfacing in America, in an American courtroom. I think that was the farthest thing from their minds. It is ironic that Claire George, who was chief of the clandestine service, the chief spy master, set up this taping operation and now may well be hoisted by his own petard.
Well, how did the prosecutor get a hold of these tapes?
Through the American legal process. God bless it. He has in the past been frustrated in his attempts to get documents from the CIA. He had to watch as his case against the former CIA station chief in Costa Rica was scuttled when Attorney General Dick Thornburgh and the CIA refused to release documents in the case. But in this instance, the CIA could not make a national security argument that tapes of possibly incriminating telephone conversations involving lies to Congress, that the national security considerations outweighed the legal considerations, the criminal justice considerations in the case. They lost that balancing test.
Why did Alan Fires testify at this time? Why did he come forward and give this information?
Well, that has been the subject of quite a lot of speculation here. Alan Fires said outside the courtroom after he pleaded guilty that he had lied 4 years ago, 5 years ago, for the good of the country, and now he was telling the truth for the good of the country. A more personal explanation might be that the prosecutors presented him with an unpleasant choice, which is that we know you lied, we can prove it, we have the transcripts, you know you lied, we can indict you for a felony, or you can cooperate, plead guilty to a misdemeanor, and in all likelihood never go to jail.
And the transcripts that the prosecutors had were the transcripts of the phone conversations.
And Alan Fires' own statements to the House and Senate Intelligence Committee and the voluminous, partially declassified depositions taken in the Iran-Contra case, the Iran-Contra investigation by Congress. He was confronted with his own words, and his words were false, and confronted with the choice of going to jail or cooperating. And like many another person has done in that situation, he swallowed hard and fessed up.
Lawrence Walsh, the chief prosecutor of Iran-Contra, has been criticized for a long, drawn-out, very expensive investigation. At the same time, Walsh has criticized the White House, the Justice Department, and the CIA for attempting to insulate and protect people.
That's right.
From prosecution. So does the Alan Fires testimony bring us to a new position in the Iran-Contra investigation? What do you think the next step is going to be?
Well, clearly the next step will be to bring Claire George, the former chief of covert operations of the CIA, into play. Mr. George was severely implicated by Alan Fires' confession. I think there may be potential problems for the former Assistant Secretary of State, Elliot Abrams. Abrams sat in a three-man group with Oliver North and Alan Fires that met regularly and, according to Fires, talked very honestly among themselves. And Fires knew about the diversion. Ollie knew everything that was going on. Either they lied a lot to Elliot Abrams or Elliot Abrams lied to Congress. I do not know where we go beyond there. There is nothing on the face of the Fires case that gives us a roadmap to the future. I do think, though, that there had been a perceived weariness about the Iran-Contra investigation. Lawrence Walsh, the independent counsel, had been frustrated in many, many avenues. And I think the public weariness about the case was a kind of a cynical sense that, you know, they're never going to get anywhere. They'll never find anything out. They'll be stonewalled. They'll be stymied. And the secrets will lie with Bill Casey, rest his soul, and those with guilty knowledge. Well, Lawrence Walsh has cracked some of the insulation that has surrounded this case for 4 years, and the sense of weariness rather quickly evaporated.
Do you think that the timing of these new revelations in Iran-Contra are especially bad for the CIA? You know, we've just ended the war with Iraq, the Cold War with the Soviet Union recently ended, and here we are with new revelations in Iran-Contra.
It is tragic that we are still dancing with the ghost of William Casey, the former CIA director. There is an enormous agenda for Bob Gates or whoever the next director of Central Intelligence is going to be, an enormous list of things to tackle. Where are we going in the world? What the heck is going on in the Middle East? Where are our hostages in Lebanon, the people we were trying to free by selling arms to Iran? What's going on in the Soviet Union? Where is it going? What's going on with global economies? Why is Panama more corrupt and screwed up than it was before we grabbed Noriega? And what should the CIA be doing in a post-Cold War world? We should be talking about those things in the confirmation hearings of the next director in Central Intelligence, and it is a damned shame that all we're going to be able to talk about now is the who shot John of Iran-Contra. That is a loss.
Of course, you're not arguing to not talk about Iran-Contra.
No, but there are many, many important topics to deal with. Look, the CIA gets a pretty bad rap sometimes. A lot of junk is written about it. America has to have an intelligence service. We are the only superpower left on this earth. We have to know what is going on in the world. An intelligence service that finds out what is going on in the world and helps predict what might happen next in the world is absolutely vital to this country. And people ought to sort of grow up and accept that. But to have the agency mired in this criminal tragedy is indicative of the costs of secrecy, too. The White House, and it was not the first time either, essentially got fed up with its own CIA and created a CIA outside the CIA to do the kinds of things that the CIA should be doing with the proper oversights. And it shot itself in the foot, and it deeply embarrassed this country and grievously wounded the intelligence community. If we ever get over the Iran-Contra affair, and it looks like it's going to be some time now, we're going to have to learn how we run a good, efficient, lean, smart intelligence service in a democracy. We've had one for almost 50 years now, and we have still not learned how to run secret operations in a democracy without hurting our democracy.
Tim Weiner, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Been a pleasure, Terry.
Tim Weiner is a Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's also the author of Blank Check, about the Pentagon's secret budget. Blank Check was just published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Have you ever noticed how some sidewalk trash cans leak a disgusting gunk from the bottom, while others invite the wind to blow the trash right out of the can? You might not pay much attention to the trash can you throw your wrappers and soda cans into, but coming up, you might see these receptacles in a new light. We talk with industrial designer Peter Bressler. He just completed a study of what makes a good sidewalk trash can. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the latest Hollywood fantasy about getting a new life regarding Henry, starring Harrison Ford and Annette Bening. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State James Baker and his Soviet counterpart continue to wrestle with the last thorny issues holding up completion of a new strategic arms reduction treaty. NPR's Ann Garrels has more on the story.
At the outset of the talks yesterday, the two ministers raised expectations the START treaty would finally be completed, opening the way to a superpower summit in Moscow at the end of July. But it's still not clear the ministers will succeed. The endgame has come down to three complicated issues. While there's been progress on two, how to guarantee access to missile test flight data and how to define new missiles, there are still serious disagreements on the third. This is known as downloading, how to reduce the number of nuclear warheads on each of the missiles so it comes down to the 6,000 limit allowed each side. U.S. officials are concerned if a 10-warhead missile were downloaded to contain only 3 warheads, for example, the Soviets could somehow sneak some extra warheads back on. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Yugoslavia's federal presidency has approved a European Community agreement on a peaceful settlement to the country's crisis. The official Yugoslav news agency said that the collective state leadership approved the agreement after a marathon session that began Friday morning and lasted until late into the night. President Bush has defended his nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court, Judge Clarence Thomas, as liberals and conservatives traded opinions about Thomas's chances for confirmation. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
In Kennebunkport today, President Bush said that the disclosure that Clarence Thomas had smoked marijuana while in college was in no way disqualifying. Earlier this week, Thomas apologized for having experimented with marijuana. The marijuana issue does not seem to have affected Thomas's support in the Senate, but another development on Capitol Hill may have an impact on his nomination. 19 black Democrats in the House, almost the entire Congressional Black Caucus, voted yesterday to fight Thomas's nomination. Even though House members have no official role in confirming Supreme Court justices, some civil rights groups say the Black Caucus move may begin to galvanize opposition to Thomas among the civil rights community. But conservative groups claim the Black Caucus was not representative of the black community. The NAACP has decided to postpone a decision on Thomas's nomination. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A strong earthquake hit nations in Eastern Europe early today. At least one person was killed and more than a dozen others were injured. The quake measured 5.5 on the Richter scale and was centered in the western part of Romania. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 21 points to close at 2,980.77 on volume of some 173 million shares. Trading today was active. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Armed Services Committee has approved a defense spending package that includes money to build more B-2 stealth bombers. The House eliminated money for the B-2 and cut money for the so-called Star Wars plan. Senate Committee Chairman Senator Sam Nunn said that the Senate panel has not yet made a final decision concerning Star Wars. Both Nunn and Senator John Warner said that they strongly supported $3.2 billion for the B-2, including $2.4 billion to buy 4 new airplanes, each costing $840 million. City officials in Los Angeles today announced that embattled police chief Daryl Gates has agreed to step down. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
Political leaders and community groups have been demanding Daryl Gates' resignation since the beating in early March of black motorist Rodney King by 4 white L.A. police officers. Gates has been able to withstand this pressure and keep his job because he's the only big city police chief in the country with civil service protection. Today, two city council members who have been among the chief's strongest supporters said that Daryl Gates agreed to retire by year's end after leading the department for 13 years. They also said they would urge a special election take place in the fall to change the city charter so that future chiefs of police would not have the civil service protection enjoyed by Daryl Gates and would be allowed to serve no longer than 10 years. Daryl Gates was in North Carolina today addressing a drug education conference. He told reporters there that he was not resigning, but that he might retire. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The government says that retail sales dropped 0.2% in June, with strong car sales showing a deeper slide. The Commerce Department said today that sales of durable goods slipped only slightly last month. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Are you the kind of person who is conscientious enough to hold on to your candy wrapper or soda can until you find a trash receptacle on the street? In some areas, finding a trash can isn't easy. But even if you do find one, it might not be very effective at keeping the litter off the street or the vermin out of the can. The city of Philadelphia is buying new street cans for a spruced-up part of town, and it commissioned an industrial design firm to study what's available and what works best. Industrial designer Peter Bressler and his company Bressler Group compared different types of receptacles, and we thought you'd be interested in the results, knowing you're probably the conscientious type, like we are. So let's begin with the can you're probably best acquainted with, the old-fashioned, ever-popular wire mesh litter receptacle.
I think they probably were great when people didn't steal trash receptacles. And they were probably great before the invention of the trash bag, because back then it was a relatively light, relatively indestructible device that the trash person could lift up, dump in the back of the truck, and it was finished. It has a cupped bottom, i.e. there is a retaining wall inside the wire mesh at the bottom that prevents drainage of half-drunken beverages. But it has the wire mesh, which allows rain to drain out. So it, by itself, when it was first invented, it was probably a real good solution, aside from the fact that a lot of people think it's basically unattractive.
But now?
Nowadays, if the city didn't pour concrete in the bottom, which makes them weigh over 75 pounds...
And the purpose of that is so
people
doesn't
can't
steal it.
Them,
yeah.
Because people are stealing them regularly. So now the city puts concrete in the bottom so they don't get stolen. The problem then is that the trash collection people can't lift them up to dump them into the truck. So they have to use a trash bag. The problem with the trash bag is that unless it's full with at least 5 pounds worth of litter, the first strong gust of wind blows it out the top of the basket like a balloon. And if all it had in it was 4 McDonald's styrofoam boxes, they just get thrown further down the street, regardless of the fact that somebody tried to put them in the trash basket in the first place.
No, I took a little tour of some of those baskets before our interview today. And in every one of the wire baskets that I passed, there was trash in between the bottom of the basket and the actual start of the plastic bag.
Yes.
Now, since the sanitation workers can't lift the basket because it's loaded down with concrete, what do? Have to scoop out the trash that's collected underneath the plastic bag?
They literally, because it's so prevalent.
Yeah.
And it's prevalent because the plastic bags break dumping trash in the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
It would be extremely inefficient if the trash collector sat there and picked all the trash out of the bottom of the wire basket by itself.
Yeah.
So they literally have to have a whole separate route with a vacuum truck that goes around and sucks the trash out of the baskets.
I've never seen one of those.
They go out at night.
Oh. So I guess we don't like these anymore, huh? These wire mesh baskets?
Evolution has created too many problems for them. They just don't work right anymore because of the changing social environment that they live in.
Now, what else were you looking at? You were looking at plastic.
Right. There's the little plastic cone heads, which are, I guess they're probably 30 inches tall. And they sit in a little bracket. They were very popular in New York City when they first came on the market. And Philadelphia decided to buy a bunch of them and try it.
These have lids, right?
No.
They don't have
lids. No, they have no lids. They also have a very soft exterior lip. which it turns out is inviting for street people to use them as commodes. And they also have a drainage hole, which means that any half-finished beverages that are thrown in it drain down through and have this nice little dripping. Eventually they make a, I think it's a stalagmite on the ground, of mountain of goo underneath them that stains the sidewalk, looks like hell. And
attracts vermin, probably.
Definitely attracts vermin. And on top of that, there are a couple of other problems with them. One, the brackets themselves are made very poorly. So most of them you'll see on the street are already broken. Secondly, in that they're plastic, if someone throws a lit cigarette in the trash, or if some vandal, which they do, throw lit matches in the trash.
It's a popular hobby in a lot of areas.
Apparently, because what you'll do is you'll walk down the street and you'll find a mountain of green melted goo in the middle of the sidewalk. So they solve some of the problems that the big trash cans had, and there was one I didn't mention, which is the propensity for commercial occupants nearby and residential occupants nearby to put full bags of trash that's supposed to be collected by commercial trash collection in the litter basket, which doubles the length of time it takes the city to empty them. The little ones cut down on that somewhat because they're smaller.
What else did you look at?
We looked at the Market Street East litter receptacles.
The Market Street East is a kind of fairly newly developed commercial area
it's
in Philadelphia.
New
urban shopping mall.
High-zoot urban mall center city thing on the east side of City Hall. And these are literally $1,200 to $1,400 cast concrete ziggurats.
Ziggurats?
Well,
Am I supposed to know that word?
this ziggurat is a Mayan temple. It's that kind of shape. And they have almost a normal wire basket and trash bag inside with a lid on top.
What's the purpose of that?
To make them look better.
So how do these function?
They function just like the wire baskets do, except they happen to have a disc of aluminum on the top with a hinge that functions as a lid with a hole in the middle, which does prevent to some degree people putting large plastic bags in it, but in fact is an inviting place for people to put large plastic bags on top of it. So aside from their cost, which is absolutely astronomical and in my mind unconscionable, they have, except for the wind blowing the plastic bag, they have all the other problems that the wire basket has.
What was your final recommendation to the city, and why did you choose that one as your recommendation?
Okay. We chose the pole-mounted receptacle. It's basically a perforated metal cylinder that has a stalk about two-thirds of the way up, perpendicular to its side, which includes a pivot, which is mounted on an existing light standard. And has a small enough diameter top that discourages large trash bags. And it is attractive in that it is less obtrusive, and it is attractive in that you see less trash, so you can have more of them available less obtrusively.
My guest is Peter Bressler, and he's an industrial designer whose firm just completed a study for the city of Philadelphia comparing the relative merits of different public trash receptacles. And we'll talk trash a little bit more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Industrial designer Peter Bressler is my guest. Let me tell you a typical problem I have with trash receptacles. Let me see if you've run across this with anyone else. Maybe it's just me. I don't know what you'd call this, but there's a kind of trash receptacle. It's really pretty big, and it's got like a hood on top. You know, it's got a cover with a little swivel door on it, and you have to push that door in to deposit your trash. And of course, that little hinged
door is always absolutely filthy, and you don't really want to touch it. But if you don't touch it, then it's hard to push it in so that your trash goes in. So what you end up doing sometimes is pushing it a little in a little bit, using the trash as a glove so that you're actually not touching this like filthy door, and the trash doesn't go all the way in and it ends up sticking up. It's like partially in, partially out. You know, you did a really sloppy job of depositing this. Is this a typical problem? Maybe I'm crazy.
No, you're not crazy at all. There is a real difficulty in designing a closing trash receptacle that doesn't take two hands to use. I think the perfect example are most of the tray return stations in fast food stores.
Yes, that's a typical place where you find this.
Where you invariably use the tray to open the door and it promptly sweeps the trash back onto your feet. Invariably, it works that way. Now, there are a couple of innovations out where some people have actually mounted handles above the doors that you pull down on the handle to open the door and then dump the can. But, I mean, that's a mild innovation. But, yeah, it's infuriating.
What did you learn about rats and roaches by doing this study?
Not too much about roaches, but I did learn that rats can chew through the bottom of concrete containers.
They can chew through concrete?
Yeah. They can't chew through the wire baskets. But they gnaw away at the mortar in the concrete. And in fact, the city collection people have found rats in the bottom of some of the Market Street containers when they went to empty them.
I think, you know, litter receptacles are a perfect example of something that everybody uses and most people spend very little time thinking about. But you had a talk with people who spend a lot of time thinking about it because they're either sanitation workers or they own businesses and they really rely on the area around their business looking clean. What are some of the most kind of passionate things people told you about? Because people get very passionate about things that matter to them. So for the people who are like really involved with the design of the receptacles, what are the more passionate things people had to say?
Interestingly enough, the most passionate things people had to say was how ugly they are, and how ugly it is when there's a bunch of trash on the ground around them. And in the case of the little green cones, how ugly the sidewalk underneath got. Even the sanitation workers didn't like when it looked bad because it made people think they weren't doing their jobs well.
Right. You spent some time following around sanitation workers with a camera to get a sense of what their needs were. So what did you learn?
Well, I learned that it's critical that the trash truck stay as close to where the men are working as it possibly can. There is nothing that makes a bigger mess or takes longer to empty trash cans than having the trash truck a half a block away. There is an interesting observation we did make, and that is that it appeared that each receptacle was emptied substantially faster if both sanitation workers worked on each receptacle together. But what happens when they divide up is it takes each one at least twice as long to service a given receptacle. And they tend to get spread apart on the block so the trash truck doesn't know where to be. It's almost a situation that needs to be choreographed. And you watch it and it builds a rhythm down the street. And the choreography of the driver with the two trash people really is critical in terms of their efficiency. They need to develop a rhythm and work together.
Would you like to take a crack at designing the perfect litter receptacle?
I'd sure like to take a crack at designing a litter receptacle. I'm not sure that anybody can design a perfect one. Designing a new litter receptacle would not be an easy project.
Why?
Because there are no straightforward answers that don't have additional problems to them.
Right.
Design is a resolution of conflicts. Okay, you have this need and you have this need and they contradict one another. If you do this, then this is going to be a problem. If you do that, then the other is going to be a problem. And finding a good design solution is finding the compromise between those two things that does work. And very often it's not an obvious answer. In the case of litter receptacles, it's not an obvious answer at all. It needs to be easy enough to empty, but difficult to steal. It needs to be big enough to hold enough litter, but not so big as to attract commercial trash. It needs to be inexpensive, yet last as long as possible. So there are a lot of conflicts, and no one seems to be much higher than the other, which in effect makes it more difficult. You know, if there were one driving problem that you had to solve, well, that's a whole lot easier project.
Yeah.
Because you can just pay all your attention to that one, not trying to balance a series of elements on a multiple seesaw.
Well, I want to thank you. I know the next time I have a wrapper to throw out, I'm going to see that litter receptacle in a completely different way. So thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Peter Bressler. He's an industrial designer whose firm just completed a study for the city of Philadelphia comparing the relative merits of different public trash receptacles. Bressler is also the past president and the current chairman of the board of the Industrial Designers Society of America. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Oh, we have a special report today from NPR's Daniel Zwerdling about the problems of deforestation in the West African country Ivory Coast. Also somewhat closer to home, we'll be hearing from Los Angeles that Police Chief Daryl Gates says that he is considering retiring, not resigning, but retiring from his post. He's, of course, under criticism and has been urged to step down by the commission that investigated the beating of motorist Rodney King. And also, we'll be hearing a preview of the Group of Seven Economic Summit in London and the plans of the U.S. to withdraw from northern Iraq but remain in nearby Turkey.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mike Nichols was one of the hottest movie directors of the 60s, with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate. But in the 70s, his box office faltered with Catch-22, Day of the Dolphin, and The Fortune. After a long silence, he made something of a comeback in the 80s. Working Girl, his hymn to making it in the big city, even turned him into a hot director again. Film critic Stephen Schiff says now Nichols is repositioning himself for the 90s with his new movie Regarding Henry.
Having trouble with the big change? Are you still yuppified and go get 'em, no matter how hard you try for kinder and gentler? Is it tough to stop spending and start saving? To stop exploiting the environment and start preserving it? Well, 80s person, Mike Nichols has the perfect solution. Get shot. That's right, go straight down to your local convenience store the way Harrison Ford, as the ruthless and formidably wealthy lawyer Henry does. Then get yourself shot in the head and chest. Not fatally. By a young thug robbing the place. And sure enough, when your coma is all over, you won't have to bother with any of the hard moral decisions the rest of us have to make. Nope, all of a sudden, you'll be pure and sweet. You won't have to answer for your past because you won't even remember it. You won't remember how to talk either, but that'll pass. All your sins will be washed away. The new, slightly brain-damaged you will automatically be kinder, gentler. Why, you'll be 90s person practically overnight. And what will you do then? Well, you'll suddenly be real attentive to the wife you've been neglecting, though why anyone would have neglected Annette Bening in the first place is beyond me. With your daughter, to whom you've always been a tyrant, you'll be like a brand new E.T., palling around everywhere, even throwing spitballs at her in the library. you'll hug your doorman. Of course, you'll willingly give up your fabulous apartment, and you'll even want to get rid of all those nasty Armani suits in your closet. In fact, while the audience cringes in disbelief, you'll decide the new nicer you doesn't really like meat and eggs. You'll give them up, too. You'll buy a puppy, just for those heart-tugging shots when it leaps around joyously at how swell you've become. Drawbacks? Well, it's true that you'll talk like a child. But heck, that can be lovable, can't it? Especially when you're at a flashy cocktail party, like the one Harrison Ford attends with Annette Bening. In this scene, they meet at the hors d'oeuvre tray.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, these little ones are really good. But that lady over there in the gold dress thinks they're a disaster. And that other woman near the window just had her face done, not her neck, just her eyes. And that other man used to be her husband. Because who is she kidding? The damage is done.
The screenwriter of Regarding Henry, Jeffrey Abrams, is only 23. Maybe he can be forgiven for the boggling cynicism and insensitivity of this movie, but Mike Nichols? Does he really think a bullet and a coma are some kind of moral cure-all? Does he really believe life can be better with brain damage than it was before, when you were burdened by all that wealth and success and glory? Tell it to James Brady, or the Central Park jogger, or any stroke victim struggling to regain what they once were. In trying to be all heartstringy and tear-jerky, Mike Nichols has created a work of almost unbelievable callousness, not to mention the worst movie of his career.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. To hear what you think about Fresh Air, and we know you may not have the time to write and let us know, so we have a new toll-free number that you can call, and this way you won't have to apologize for your bad typing. The number is 1-800-NPR-WHYY. We're ready for the honest truth at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. And now I'd like to welcome the listeners of station KXPR in Sacramento, which just picked up Fresh Air. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Dorothy Farabee, our administrative assistant. Chris Burden directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bela Davidovich was one of the Soviet Union's most prominent musicians. Her son, Dmitry Sitkovetsky, was one of the Soviet Union's most promising young musicians. On the next Fresh Air, Sitkovetsky tells us how he and his mother left the Soviet Union for the West. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Our forecast for tonight, cloudy skies. There's a 70% chance of showers towards morning. Look for an overnight low of about 70 degrees. Right now, it's a minute before 8.